Thank you for spending the middle of this afternoon with us here and sharing your spring break with us as well. It didn't feel like spring break when I got out of the car on our parking lot a while ago without my jacket. I hope you've had a good day. Thanks to those of you who've been here all day working with the LTC groups and LTC projects. And we appreciate very much your effort and interest. Thanks to those of you who will be helping to make visits to people this week. Remember to check the table out here if you'd like to help with that good work. And everybody, remember the ministry of intercessory prayer. There are many reasons for that. And one of the best ways to illustrate the priesthood of all believers is that good work of praying for each other. So we encourage you to make good use of that privilege. I want you to try to imagine with me what this would be like. Suppose your people has been brought very low for years by neighbors off to the south and east who live off in the rough land. I don't necessarily think of Mississippi or Louisiana. That's not the situation I'm talking about. Think instead about where the people of Israel would have been in the days that we're talking about here tonight. And suppose that a pattern has developed over these years that these peoples who are far more numerous and more powerful than your own people have also mastered the use of camels and other animals like that, and that has made them able to move around quickly and has made them powerful, and it has also made them just consume whatever is before them. And they have learned the timing of your own people's harvest, the ingathering of your crops, the time when your vines would be ripe or your trees would be bearing their fruit, and that every time you have harvested over the years, they have showed up, and it's gotten to the place where they just bring their tents and they camp in your land, and they consume every bit of your produce and everything your family would depend upon and every bit of your country's national product. Suppose it's gotten so bad that at harvest time, just to feed your family, you have gotten to the place where you have to, instead of going to a threshing floor where your wheat would normally be cared for, you're having to hide in a wine vat somewhere in order to try to beat out the wheat just to keep it from getting stolen. And one night late, under the cover of darkness, you're involved in that project, and you hear this voice: "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." Would you have any questions? Gideon is the person who was in that situation and who heard that address to him from the angel of the Lord. Gideon is the fifth one of the judges. He lives about 200 years after Joshua. And this is the one question that we're going to deal with in our series on the questions that impact life from this time period. It's not the question I usually think of when I remember Gideon. It turns out that the one I remember is actually his second question. I remember Gideon's army and the way it got reduced and the funny way they went about the battle and all of that, and the unique weaponry they used in the battle. But this question is actually the one behind all of that. When Gideon is addressed this way by the angel. He said to him, "Please, sir," or "Please, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian." Now please think with me for a moment about the question that Gideon is posing here. If the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? I'm pretty confident that all of us in our heart of hearts have already either had occasion to raise this question, or we will, unfortunately, at some moment in our lives. All of us will have times when we remember that the Lord does promise to be with us. I mean, after all, our Lord was God with us, and his promise in finishing his mission was, "I'm with you always, even to the end of the world." And in the letter of encouragement in the New Testament, there's the promise recounted, "I won't fail you or forsake you." But bad things do happen in our lives. That is no secret, is it? I mean, that's just the reality. And sometimes really bad things happen in our lives. I have seen occasions where this question has been asked, if not in my own family, then in my mind, in what I've seen other families have to go through. And I've seen times, and I think most of you have, if you really think about it, when because of this situation, even gathering with the Lord's people and talking about how he loves us and how he's faithful to us and how he cares for us, seems to only either be shallow talk or to inflict greater injury at certain moments in our lives. This is how life really is. Now, while it's true that we may have asked this question of ourselves, it is important for our study tonight for us to realize that this time when it's asked, there is a particular context to it, a particular background to it, and the background to it will be significant in how we try to think about how this question is to be handled or dealt with. For one thing, the covenant people of God at this time have been faithless to the covenant that they have with God. They have been disloyal. They have broken the promises that they made to God, the ones that had been emphasized to them over and over again as they entered into the land of promise. At verse 1 of this chapter, if you back up and look, it says, "The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. Well, what's happening here is simply that the terms of the covenant have been affirmed in the lives of these people for these 7 years. You can't have a covenant and only have promises. The covenant had not only blessings that applied to the people of God, but also curses upon them if the covenant was broken. You can't have a covenant that promises or that brings true blessings without there being penalties if it is broken. If you consider any kind of a contract that you may enter into in your life, that would be half of the story. A contract may be thought of as a type of a covenant in that the two parties obligate themselves to each other. And if either of them break the terms of that contract, then there are debts or obligations that are due. A covenant in the Bible has not only that aspect to it, but also the element of love mixed into it, where not only has there been a broken promise, but there has been heartbreak that enters the picture in the faithlessness that is involved. Now, what has happened is that the Lord is with them now because He is being faithful to that covenant. Back in Deuteronomy 28, at verse 25, He had told them that if they go into the land and if they engage in the idolatry of the land and break their covenant to Him, then they're going to end up fleeing in seven ways before their enemies. And He went ahead to promise them that if they in their hardship under their enemies, if they then would turn their hearts back to Him, and if they would humble themselves and pray to Him and cry out to Him, then He would be there for them. Well, in verse 8 or verse 6 of this chapter, it says that when Israel was brought very low, the people of Israel cried out for help to the Lord. The Lord had been faithful to the covenant when they were delivered to the hands of the Midianites, and He was being faithful to them when they cried out to Him just as He said. God being with His people does not mean that there are never any circumstances like this to deal with in life. What happens to Israel here does not mean that every time there's hardship in people's lives, God's unhappy with them or that He is somehow exercising a penalty on them. These people had a covenant obligation to God, and what's taking place is in keeping with what God promised. So we bear that in mind as we think through this passage. Now, with the question ringing in our hearts, if God is with us, why has all this happened to us? Let's try to learn a little bit from the answer to the question, which is not ever completely stated, but it plays out. And what the answer, the way God answers this, kind of reminds us that if we're going to ask this question, we may want to bear in mind how God answered it to this fellow at this time in history. What happens is that Gideon says, if God's with us, why has all this happened to us? So God gives him a battle to fight that can't possibly be won by on Gideon's own power. If you're going to ask, how can I know you're with me? Then God has to let something happen that there couldn't be a victory over in any other way. And it may not be fun while it's happening. Look at how this goes on in chapter 6 at verses 14 and 15. The Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do not I send you? And he said, please, Lord, how can I save Israel? That's the question I remember. Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my father's house. And God's answer is almost as if, well, Gideon, you wanted to know that I was with you. And I'm going to have to be with you then. If you are the least in your clan is the weakest in the country, then you're the guy I need to use in order to show that I'm with you. And you remember then how the story, the more famous parts of this story unfold from there. The Midianites do indeed come up and camp out along with their friends, the Amalekites, at harvest time. They're just like a swarm of locusts consuming everything in front of them. The Lord tells Gideon in chapter 7 and verse 2, Gideon has gathered together some of the people in the country with him, and he has some 32,000 odd soldiers, sort of soldiers from all the different parts of his country. And God says, they're too many. I don't know where I read the number, but somewhere an estimate of 135,000 on the other side. And God said, there's too many. And you remember how it comes down, finally, the different tests for it comes down to 300. God says to Gideon, all right, now, I've given you a mighty army of 300 farmers. We're ready for battle. You want to know that I'm with you. In verse 12, you see the huge gathering of the Midianites and Amalekites that lie out there in front of them, and they're camels without number, and they're like sand on the seashore, and you got 300 along with Gideon. That's the army that he uses. Are they going to be able to overcome unless God is with them? Well, obviously not. And especially when you think about the weapons that they're going to use, and we'll see in a few moments. The second thing that happens in this answer is that God is kind enough to grant Gideon reassurance that this really is His word. But once that's done, He expects Gideon to act on His word. Now, I can see why Gideon would need this. There's the background of idolatry which is going on in the land. That's why his people have trouble. How would they know what God has said and whether it's really God? As long as God's been dealing with His people, there have always been those claiming to speak for God that didn't. And it could have been happening at that time. And the second thing is that what God was asking of him made so little sense to him that he needed to know it was really God's word. So in verses 16 and 17, the Lord said, "But I'll be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites as one man." And he says, "If now I've found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me." Skip down to verses 20 and 21. Gideon brings the flour and the basket with the offering in it. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened cakes and put them on this rock and pour the broth over them." And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord reached out the tip of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened cakes, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. I'd like to know more than I do about who this angel of the Lord. I don't picture him with the way some of the angels get pictured in art and nice touchy-feely type of things. But this is the way God reassured Gideon he really had his word. You and I depend on a word that has been spoken by those who knew the Lord and confirmed to us with the mighty signs and wonders that God worked through their hands. And we try to pay attention to it. That's what Hebrews 2 verses 3 and 4 tells us to do. Thirdly, God requires Gideon to remove the evil that has gotten ingrained in the land and even in his own family experience, and then to express covenant faithfulness again. God can't help people who are insistent on unfaithfulness to Him. So this has to be corrected. In verse 25 and following, It says that that night the Lord said to Gideon, I want you to take your father's bull and then a second bull, and I want you to go pull down the altar of Baal that your father has and cut down the grove or the groves or the Asherah, the female deity poles that were supposed to were a part of Canaanite life, or had been a part of Canaanite life. I want you to pull down that altar and cut down all of those things and build an altar to the Lord and use those things as the fire underneath it and offer that other bull. Use one to pull it down and use the other one as an offering. And turn that idolatry into service to the Lord instead. What he's doing is removing the evil and reestablishing right service to God in keeping with the covenant. Once that's done, God provides support and encouragement to Gideon as he needs it, as he goes to attend to the responsibility that's given to him. God doesn't give someone strength so that he'll know he's strong enough. But while the person's doing it, God sustains him. When a person establishes loyalty to God, then God will establish that person in doing what God gives him to do. And in Gideon's case, there's two episodes of this, both quite well known. One is at the end of chapter 6, where Gideon... Wants to know, if you'll save Israel by my hand, as you've said, I'm going to lay a fleece, the skin of a sheep or an animal out on the ground, and in the morning, if you're really going to save us through my hand, let the fleece be wet but the ground dry. He goes out the next morning, sure enough, the ground's dry, and he can wring a bowl full of water out of the fleece. He runs the risk of asking for still further assurance. The next day, let the ground be wet, but the fleece dry. And God does that too, just to say, it really is me, and I'm really with you. God would go that far. Then when they're ready, he has the army ready, and the attack is still to be done. God tells him, if you have anyone who's afraid, then I want you to go down to the camp with a servant and to the enemy camp, and I want you to sneak in and listen quietly, secretly to what they're saying. And he goes down there at that huge camp. And he hears one of the men of Midian saying to the other one, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. This is chapter 7, verse 13. And his comrade answers him, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. Sometimes we think that discouraging talk only goes on in our lives. It was going on in the enemy camp as well. The confusing messages and the rumors that make people afraid and so forth was taking its toll on Midian. And what God is telling Gideon is, these folks are not as strong as they look to you right now. There's not as much reason to be afraid as you may think. Gideon then is ready to go do what God has sent him to do. And our story tells us that God gives him the victory after the enemy has been met by faith. You might remember from the Hebrew writer in Hebrews 11 and verses 32 through 34. Remember, that's the place in that great faith chapter where he says, "And what more can I say?" And he starts talking about the people who've conquered kingdoms and so forth. Gideon is the first name in that part of the list in that great chapter. In this case, Gideon, having heard all of this, goes back to his camp, tells them that the Lord has given the host of Midian into their hand. Remember the three, all 300 of them. He gives them empty clay jars with torches inside the jars, and then horns or trumpets. And he tells them that when they're going to divide up into three groups, 100 each. And when they see him break the jar, they're to break theirs. And when he blows the trumpet, they're to do the same. And when he holds forth his torches, they do the same. And they all cry out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." When they do that, I mean, they actually go to battle and do that. I would have already have had my escape route planned, I think. If I hold forth a torch, that would just mean they can see me. They actually do it. And when they do, the Midianite camp falls into confusion and they start attacking each other. And then they start fleeing from the huge enemy that they is only there in their imagination. And they're totally, totally defeated by the end of chapter 7. Gideon turned out to be more of a mighty man of valor than he looked, because God was with him, even though it didn't seem to be the case. Now, I can't drop the story there. I need to point out to us that God, what happens now is that God sends Gideon again into the everyday task of covenant faithfulness in the routine world of people and their problems. Remember that what caused all of this to start with was unfaithfulness to the covenant in everyday routine life. And this great victory lasts a moment. And then there's life to be lived. And what happens in chapter 8 and verse 1, you got some of the people of Israel who claim that their feelings were hurt because they weren't called to the battle soon enough. You attacked them without us. It's laughable to read that. Why hadn't they already, if they were so eager to attack, why hadn't they done it? And then a little later in chapter 4, Gideon comes to the Jordan and crosses over it with his army of 300, and they're exalted, and he asks some of the people of the town there to give them just some loaves of bread since they're exhausted from the battle, and they refuse to do it. Not too much appreciation there. And then the next thing you know, the people are wanting Gideon to rule over them. And Gideon says, "No, the Lord will rule over you." But he does take up all the gold and have an ephod made. And that becomes a snare to his family over time. People start breaking the obligation to worship the Lord and Him only all over again. This is a passage of Scripture, I think, that makes us stop and think about how God is going to be able to show us that He's with us. And friends, at some point or another, when we think of this in the light of the New Testament, we get reminded that what we really need is a God who is capable of defending His own covenants that He makes. that the way for us to be able to trust His promises is to know that God will say something and then stand by it and do so faithfully and loyally and mercifully. Something happens in the long toward the end of chapter 6 in this story that I think I should leave us with. After Gideon has broken down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah and all of that kind of stuff, the people who've been involved in that stuff are all upset over it in the morning when they find out not only what happened, but who did it. So they go to Gideon's father and they tell him, bring out your son that he may die, for he's broken down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah beside it. But Gideon's dad says something pretty wise. This is chapter 6, verse 31. Will you contend for Baal, or will you save him? And then toward the end of the verse, if he is God, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down. That's a pretty thoughtful saying, isn't it? If he's really God, let him defend his own altar. If you've got a God who cannot defend his own cause, you got too little of God. You need a God who's able to to establish a covenant and then to enforce it and stand by it. Jesus said, "This is my blood of the new covenant shed for many for the forgiveness of sins." Let us make sure that we stand in covenant relation to the Lord, and then that we're faithful to Him in loving Him in everyday life. If you're needing to make a beginning at that and making the good confession and being baptized into Him, we'd rejoice to see that happen tonight if you'll let us know of your desire while we stand and sing together.